Good morning, everyone. Today is Sunday, July 12th, 2015. We welcome you all to our roundtable. There were a couple of sort of business things I wanted to take care of first. One is, I know a lot of you enjoy taking pictures. Some of you have been doing some traveling. So we would very much love if some of the pictures that you take you'd like to send so we can use on our website carousel. We like to keep them fresh and different, and you know, some of you have gone around the world. So please, if you have some beautiful pictures of God's creation that you feel would be appropriate, do send them to Jeremy. He's the one who puts them on the carousel. Also, this past Wednesday, at the testimony meeting, we had a couple of testimonies that rambled too long. The two that did it had been spoken to, so if you weren't spoken to, your testimony was fine. But we just want to remind you again what a testimony should be. Does anyone want to offer anything?
One thing to keep in mind is you're speaking to a listening audience. So consider your motive for giving. If you want to tell your story, that's not a good motive. But if it's actually going out to reach someone and bless them with something that happened, then that's more in line with a correct motive. And just think about it. People that are on the listening end don't want to hear a story that goes on and on and on and on. How do you like if somebody does that to you? So that's one point.
If you speak too long, you will lose your audience, and the point will be missed. Also, confine it to one healing, because the minute someone will give, and it'll perhaps be a good healing, and then they'll say, oh, and another thing happened, and then last week this happened, and you just start going on and on. If several things happen, save it for next week. One healing. Keep it simple. Sometimes the shorter the better. Definitely stay no longer than 4 minutes, and hopefully less. And don't go into so much detail about every little thing that happened. It might be fascinating to you, but it isn't to everybody else. So, and I say this with great love and kindness, and I've told you before, all of us here have had to learn what constitutes a good testimony. And over and over and over again, we would be reminded, because sometimes you forget. And this is only said in love. Our meetings go out on YouTube. They're on our carousel. They go all over the world. People are listening to it, and we want it to be of the highest caliber. And that I don't mean to intimidate you from giving it. If your heart is speaking, then that's all that's necessary. Because heart speaks to heart. Anybody else?
I think, having said that, there should be no fear, too, that you're going to be criticized by sharing what has blessed you to bless others.
Yes, that's right. No fear. The only fear is to offend God. And if your testimony isn't up to standard, it is an offense to God. So you should have that fear.
Now, if you have great gratitude for the truth that has blessed you, then you have nothing to fear. The world is hungering for the truth that you have to offer.
And after saying that, I will say that our testimony meetings, the readings and the testimonies are for the most part absolutely wonderful. Every week I'm amazed. Only God could be doing this and doing this work. Wonderful healing, heartfelt, no pride. Everybody's willing to share, no feeling like, oh, I don't want to tell anyone what happened to me. They're beautiful testimonies. So I thank you very much for that. Also, give the statement that helped you, the statement of truth, whether from the Bible or something practitioner gave you from one of the writings of Mrs. Eddy, but that's very helpful to everyone. It is, and it grounds it in the truth. whether it's science and health or the Bible, it brings it to God. If you get up and give a testimony and never mention God, well, there's usually something wrong with that. So, and I've heard them. So, okay.
I was saying also share what you learned from the healing, what you realized through it.
So. Yes. You've grown in some way. There should be a healing, okay? It should be some definite healing. And it's also good to, if there are a lot of testimonies that aren't about physical healing, then sometimes it's good for you, if you realize that, to give one about a physical healing. People are always interested in that. So, anyway, keep all those things in mind, and thank you all for...
Most of you do a great job.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Just a reminder. The other thing is today the forum was wonderful all week, and I'm probably going to call on some of you to either give your forum submissions or talk about them, especially now since we haven't been doing the Bible study. So, subject today, sacrament. Golden text, 1 Peter. Sanctify the Lord in your heart. So anyone on that? In a way, this is the theme of the lesson. So what is it? What is this telling us?
Make him first. Put him first in your heart.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Well, sometimes I think Mrs. Eddy had this subject sacrament for such a specific reason, because I think the general religious thought of sacrament is that you do some outward motion to prove that you're pious, like you do go through a ceremony where you eat bread and drink wine or whatever, or get baptized in a pool of water by some official. But that outward thing had to be corrected. So we have something like sanctify the Lord God in your hearts is putting in its right place, away from the outward motions into the spiritual realm, getting yourself right with God. That's what God requires.
Thank you. That word sacrifice, it means purification, or excuse me, sanctify. The word sanctify means purification, preparing oneself for divine service.
That's why this psalm that comes after is so appropriate, creating me a clean heart and a right spirit.
Thank you. It is. This psalm of David is a purification psalm, you can say. It's a beautiful psalm. Does anyone know when he wrote this?
Was it after he was repenting for with the sleeping with the woman that was not his wife?
Bathsheba, yes, it was. After he had been talked to by the prophet Nathan. So if any of you feel, you know, that you've committed some kind of a sin or crime or whatever, this is a psalm to turn to. I mean, David had to have been extremely low at that point.
He's asking God to renew a right spirit within him. He knew that the right spirit was within him. He had just lost it. And he asked God to restore unto him the joy of his salvation.
And to blot out his transgressions.
Yes. But go ahead, Gary, what were you...
To restore something that is his nature, his natural. It is natural that the joy of God's salvation is within each one of us. Sometimes we just need to have it restored.
I think exactly right.
Go ahead.
Right. I was going to say, I think it's a psalm to turn to even when you're feeling just low, because it may not necessarily be that you you're aware that you've done something wrong, but those feelings that come, sometimes you just feel low, and it's a beautiful psalm to just turn to, making God holy, feeling, not making him holy in the sense of you're going to make God holy, but recognizing this holiness and revering him and just thanking him with deep gratitude for what he's done for you and everything. I mean, I just, it reaches the heart, that psalm.
It does. Thank you, Florence.
Yeah, because it's a recognition that God is there and that God can do all these things. Sometimes we, you know, you're right. Sometimes you're feeling low, and sometimes it's just a matter of sort of kind of losing track of God or not feeling his presence. And when you reach out to him with an expectation, then your joy gets restored.
I've used it. Have you ever, you know, just when you're feeling upset or disgruntled, you wake up in the morning just, what is that, on the wrong side of the bed, as they say, or something where you're just not feeling right. That will come to me, renew a right spirit within me. Because that's the wrong spirit. You're feeling negative. All of those things, yes. And then to realize, absolutely, your original state is one of joy and one of peace. You've stepped out of that for some reason, but you can certainly restore and regain it, as the psalm says.
And then there are times when you might feel a little discouraged, wondering if your work is having any effect at all. That's the double tool, discouragement. And this will blow it away.
Yeah, restore unto me the joy of thy salvation. So when you're discouraged, you've lost the joy of the work that you're doing. And God will restore it to you and remind you of his goodness and presence when you seek him with all your heart and soul.
And I thought it was really a good sign, and one of the reasons why David is so revered, that he says, then will I teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. Here he was the king, and he saw his primary purpose to teach transgressors God's ways.
And he knew he could only do it when he had purified and sanctified himself. It is a tremendous example. He didn't just say, oh, well, that never happened, and I'll go on as king, and so what that I killed a man and all this other stuff, committed adultery. No, he knew he couldn't go forward unless he cleared his slate, as we say, in tremendous humility. That's why he was such a great king. Quite an example. There's another example of this, too, in this week's lesson, and that is John the Baptist. John the Baptist was also, he was considered a great man. It said when he'd been filled with the Holy Ghost from the womb, and he was greatly revered. And yet, what happens in this story, in the lesson?
When he asked Jesus to baptize him?
Yes.
When Jesus asked him.
Sorry.
Well, but you were getting to the point. Yes.
Right. And he says, I have need to be baptized of thee, and thou comest to me. That showed what humility he had. He said, I'm the one that you should be baptizing me. And he said this in front of all the people that revered John. He was a humble man to admit that. This is a sign of true greatness. It really is. If anyone you think is great or good doesn't express that humility, then they are not. And Jesus' answer was, suffer it so to be now. Thus it becometh us to fulfill all righteousness. And he suffered him. What does that mean about suffering it now to be so?
Suffer it to be so.
I get the sense of, this is necessary now. This may not be what we think we should do, but it is necessary to do this now.
Thank you. I'm bringing this out because this is the wisdom. Wisdom must be in all our actions. If you truly love, you will have wisdom. And we sometimes see, you can see it in many places, but if you force something, or as a Christian Scientist, you want to make your point and push it, that can ruin it. It's like a flower unfolding, and you rip the flower open before it has unfolded. Sometimes you just have to let it be for a while. Let God work. You all understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, and also, Jesus knew that his mission was to be an example for mankind. He had an audience, if you will, and he respected that he was here to help others. He wasn't here for himself or for God. He was here for mankind. And here was John and John's disciples baptizing people. And that was the highest thought on earth at that point. And these were, the best of the best. And Jesus had a mission to lift even their thoughts and to use them to help bless mankind. And it was considered the law, like paying your taxes, to be baptized. So he did that.
Church law.
Yeah, church law. and what happened when he was baptized? They all saw something very special, didn't they? And they heard something very special.
This is my beloved son. Very thankful for.
I am well pleased. Yes. Yeah. So because he was obedient and did suffer it so to be now, he was greatly blessed by that. And so will we be. And I know we've all gone over that pond in purpose, but it's a good one to go over often. And it talks about this, the real baptism, the real purification process that must go on within each one of us. So Jesus used wisdom in all his ways. So must we. I would like to jump now to Florence. I wanted you to talk about what you wrote on the forum about Jesus was no ascetic.
Oh, okay. No.
You gave the definition of it.
Uh-huh. It's right here. One second. Jesus, the verse was from Science and Health. Jesus was no ascetic. He did not fast as did the Baptist disciples. Yet there never lived a man so far removed from appetites and passions as the Nazarene. And I looked up the meaning of ascetic. It's retired from the world. one who retires from the customary business of life and devotes himself to the duties of piety and devotion, a hermit, a recluse. He was among the people. Jesus was going everywhere. I don't think he just kept himself in some room, you know, praying or anything like that. He went there, and the reason why I, you know, came to my mind to write it is because this is the work we have to do, like he did. Wherever we are, it's amazing because our work is mental. You can be working everywhere, and I find myself sometimes when I get in touch with like customer service people, or you know, I find myself getting irritated. I'm like, no, what do I do here? You know, this is the test, as far as I'm concerned, as to how far I've come in practicing this truth. You know, my reactions to these things prove where I am. If I get all angry and stay there, it shows that I'm not doing too well. And so I think it's great that he gave that example of being everywhere and using the truth, seeing only the man that God has created. It's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. That is just wonderful, because I've seen the opposite, where people want to just hide in their homes, and it is hiding in their homes, and not go out among the people. And sometimes they even code it with the words personal sense, that they don't want to, you know, it's personal sense to go and meet with someone or see someone. And that's why on our carousel this week we've had the article Personality by Mrs. Eddy in Retrospection and Introspection, where she said if someone talks about that too much, they're the ones steeped in personal sense. You need to be out amongst people at times. And that you're right, it's a test. Are you living it? Are you in that right spirit? Or are you getting irritated and annoyed and then just want to go back to your room and not deal with anyone? I know, because I see that way. Go ahead.
Or are you condemning people even before you get there? I mean, there are certain family members that maybe behave a certain way. So before a gathering, are you already expecting that that's how they're going to behave? You know, in other words, you're really attaching an error to them. So it's a great test as far as I'm concerned. Where is my thinking? Everywhere. Wherever I am, whatever I'm doing, where is my thinking?
Yes.
Right. And what do you love?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, this is even institutionalized in some religions. I mean, think there are monks living in monasteries, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it must be very tempting for a very, you know, kind of so-called pure-minded, righteous person to just say, oh, I just, all this, you know, all this mortal stuff I just find so offensive. I'm going to go in my monastery and pray to God and be pure. And what good does that do?
Now, there are times, and you should spend times alone with God. And as we know, Jesus went to the mountaintop often. And when he came back, he was able to heal. And you know when maybe you've had enough. And we're not either advocating to go out amongst the world constantly until you don't know which end is up, but we're just saying you shouldn't retreat from it either or be a recluse. That's not science. It's not love. It's not loving your brother. And so we bring it out as part of the discussion on sacrament and purification.
And that gets to another point. The idea of taking a vacation is pretty common. You know, people work hard, they need a break. I guess that's sort of normal. But if you're working in the truth, what should a vacation do for you? And what should you look forward to in a vacation if you're a real working scientist?
I would think it would bring you closer to God. Farther.
I agree. Yeah, because if it doesn't, has it done any good?
No.
No.
No. Now, Mrs. Evans used to talk about vacations as a time to recharge your batteries, your spiritual batteries.
Now, refreshment is a divine idea. Back in the beginning, the concept of Sabbath was established at the very beginning of the Bible. It's there for a purpose. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. Remember those times to commune with God and refresh your heart with Him. Because those are sacred times. We should have this Sabbath every day.
Thank you.
At least once a week.
Well, and it is watching point 214 in which Mrs. Eddies is quoted on her remarks on travel, which I've given most of you, but it's a good one to be familiar with. And yes, it should be a time you should come back better able to do the work. You shouldn't come back and need a week to recover. Wait, but believe me, I've had those kind of vacations. They're not worth it.
If you come back with jet lag and you need a week to nap, recover from jet lag.
Yeah, or other things. It can be a holy time if you make it that, or it can be hell. It's all, again, your motive. So, now we have the story of the disciples not being able to heal the lunatic, and Jesus telling them that this kind goeth not out, but by prayer and fasting. We've talked about this before. Linda did a post on Watching Point from Carpenter, which thoroughly explains it. So, Linda, can you read that for us?
Yes.
Thank
it
you.
Says, error is sustained by mortal mind's belief in it, and truth is put into operation by being brought into consciousness as a reality. Fasting and prayer must mean denial and affirmation, starving error and accentuating truth. You starve error by making nothing of it, by refusing to acknowledge it, think about it, or believe in it. You feed truth and build up a consciousness of good by emphasizing it, affirming it, and trusting in it. Thus we have the perfect rule, starve error by seeing its nothingness, until it falls and is self-destroyed from lack of support. Build up a consciousness of good until it becomes so real to you that you can feel its presence constantly. Trust in it as a power outside of yourself, which you reflect, and know that it is operating in the world and through you by your reflection of it. That was it.
Do you know the number of that Watching Point?
No, but I can probably find it in a minute, so I'll look it up while you...
Okay. So I used to wonder about that. I mean, years ago, before I knew the answer, I thought fasting, you know, what you think fasting is, you don't eat and all of that stuff. But this is the perfect answer. It's the truth, and it aligns perfectly with everything Mrs. Eddy has given us. You starve the error. You don't think about it. You stand quarter at the door of thought, as Mrs. Eddy says. And as you do that and you bring in truth into your consciousness and declare the truth, that's something staff to lean on. It's something that you have. And that is the truth. And that will heal the situation. Because whatever the situation is, it is mental. It is not physical. When you get it straight in your thought, your body, your finance, your emotions, whatever else needs correcting, will adjust itself. Any comments or questions?
Let's get specific. Starving error. What kind of errors need to be starved? What are we talking about here?
Resentment? Fear?
All error.
Yeah.
Pardon?
False beliefs.
Like what?
Oh, a belief that somebody is talking, saying things and that you are not able to fight against it. That you are helpless in the face of what's going on?
Well, this
is a false belief.
Well, that's a good false belief. Feeling you're feeling you're a victim.
Like you're a victim.
Exactly. Or that you don't have enough, you know, that your finances are dependent on freelance jobs. That's a false belief.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
Any other examples?
you're supposed to be sick for some reason or another.
Right. Sickness is justifiable. What about other errors that need to be starved? How about, like, a selfish motive? Anybody have any selfish motives going on?
Oh, please don't make me tell them all.
And this is why we work with Daily, the rule for motives for that. Well, do you want to say anything more? Because this is a segue into the next story.
No, before you go, that was watch number 87.
87 on prayer and fasting. Mm. Thank you, Linda.
Yeah.
Thank you.
What about the children of Zebedee? What kind of motives did they have?
They totally didn't get it. You know, they were interested in some sort of hero worship, but they did not get it. It was not about, you know, they were asking for something they did not have the ability to fulfill.
Yes.
No humility.
Human pride.
Exactly, yes.
They wanted to make themselves look good by saying, hey, look who we're sitting next to.
Yeah, they didn't want to do any work for anything. They just wanted all the glory.
Right.
And their mother was their spokesperson.
Yeah, I mean, originally that was a story. I thought, well, she was just so full of pride about her children. And that could be true, but then I've also read that she humbly served Jesus, and that her sons wanted her to speak in their behalf, thinking that maybe, well, Jesus would listen to my mother. Might not sound good if I asked myself. And they were, according to Matthew Henry, it was James and John, and they were two of the first three of Christ's disciples. Peter being the third, they were good disciples. I mean, good relatively speaking. But to ask for this, they had no understanding about where Jesus was or what it took to get there. This is what the sometimes someone new in science or a very naive person will want with someone who has worked years to demonstrate. And they think, well, it looks easy, just like you watch an ice skater and think, oh, wow, that looks easy. And then you go on the ice and you fall flat on your face. It's not easy. It didn't just happen. So be careful about that. And I have seen it, because it will operate in churches where people want positions.
It's human competition, too.
It is. And there was more of that, too, because how did the other disciples react at that request?
They were furious.
They were furious. And not because it was a stupid request, but why?
We put them down. I mean, they thought they were that good.
That's right.
You know, there was another time when Jesus knew, without them actually speaking in his earshot, that they were contending among themselves who was going to be the greatest. You know, this is an error. And
it's common
among humanity. But it is an error. Jesus knew. He says, what were you talking about back there? Finally confessed.
It's one really to watch out for, because it is common everywhere. It's common in business and common, but unfortunately, it also can be common in church. It shouldn't be. If you know anything about science at all, you shouldn't seek positions.
And you know, when Christ said something about that, in the end, after they asked him, or Peter asked him, what will we get from, you know, if we are good and we're your disciples? And he said, you'll be at the head of the tribes of Israel and so on. I can't quote it. But in the end, at the very end, he said, but the first shall be last and the last shall be first.
Yes.
That made a real impression.
It was his point, the greatest shall be the servant. So it gives an idea of who's got the clean heart.
Matthew Henry said that these they imagined, these disciples, James and John, they imagined their warfare was over when it had just begun. They thought, oh, well, you know, we left our fish and nets, and so now what's in it for us? We took the first step, so what do we get in return? Watch out for that kind of thought. Because I hear it, and I'm sure Florence does too, in the practice where, you know, you take a few days where you're thinking correctly or you're doing whatever, and so how come I haven't gotten this, that, and the next thing? Wait a minute. Holy Moses. It's not up to you, my friend.
Yeah. I mean, it's such an offensive demand, really. I mean, who are you talking to?
Exactly.
You know?
Well, and we have seen over the years people who weren't elected to the position that they wanted retaliated or just packed up their marbles and left.
Yeah, I had forgotten, and maybe I mentioned this, but this was a small church. It's now closed, but they had, I guess it was some rich man who wanted to be on the board or wanted to be something, and when he wasn't elected, he started his own church. You know, another Church of Christ Scientists, but Mrs. Evans always maintained that it was based on a wrong motive, and therefore it couldn't prosper.
And it didn't.
And it didn't. No. And it is now closed. The gospel of Christ teaches peace and unity, loving your neighbor as yourself. It when practiced correctly, it draws people together. But I read this was too, and it's so true, from Matthew Henry. He said the effect of preaching the gospel often results in division. And that's because people aren't ready to get it. And so they'll fight back. Or they'll separate themselves. And remember, in our warfare, I guess you could call it, with the organization.
The human mind.
they did excommunicate us. True, we refused to support their board of directors 100%. Absolutely not. We would not do that. And then we were excommunicated. We did not leave them. They excommunicated us. I know our original intent was to work within it.
But God had something better for us.
God did. God did. So these are all things to think about. Think about for yourself. And also along with James and John, Jesus never, he was a servant, wasn't he? He washed their feet. So must we be. That keeps your humility. Once you're seeking position, once you think you know it all, once you think you want this, that, or the next thing, you are way out there. You know, in the story of David, King David, we talked about his humility. When he was being pursued by Saul was trying to kill him. David had many chances to kill Saul. David never promoted himself. He never promoted himself. God promoted him. When it was time, he became king. But even at that time, he could have killed Saul, and then I guess probably would have been king. He was ordained in a way to be king. He'd been chosen. But he didn't do that. He suffered it so to be now. Saul had been chosen, and he respected that until the end, until he was almost forced into the position. And so it should be with us. You get pretty much forced into it in some way. It becomes very clear it's what God wants you to do. And when that is the case, lo and behold, you're ready for it. Even if you didn't want it. There have been many things I've been asked to do or have done that I didn't want to do, but when the time came, it was obvious that I was ready to do it, and it's what God wanted me to do. And Florence has said that over and over in her case as well. And I'm sure you're finding it true in your experience. God does the promoting. When you're humble and serve humbly and have no aspirations to be great and mighty and to be what you think is so wonderful, whether it's reader or whatever, then
that's when you're ready.
That's when you're ready. That's when you're ready. And when the time is right, it will happen. Any questions? And sometimes it happens even when you're screaming and protesting. No.
I had a question. Near the end of this story, Jesus, in Luke, Jesus says, I am come to send fire on the earth, and what will I if it already be already kindled? But I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how am I straitened till it be accomplished? What did he mean? What is the word? What does the word straitened mean here? What's he telling us?
I would say purified.
You must have something in mind, Gary. I read the fire on earth was the fire of persecution, and it had already started. And persecution is one of the most purifying processes you can go through if you stand under it and don't run from it. Because you're forced to turn to God. You have no other aid. You're being persecuted, you're only doing right, and you're being persecuted for that. How unjust is that? How unjust? Where is God, for heaven's sakes? Why is this happening, for heaven's sakes? You got to stop all those questions and bow your head low. And if you do, the arrow that doth wound the dove starts not from those.
Watch.
And love.
Yeah.
Yes. So what were you going to say?
Well, no, I thought that was very very insightful. I always respect what Florence has to say. The the dictionary definition means restricted or confined or narrowed some way. And I thought, yes, he's being purified, but he's also being restricted by all these pompous thoughts around him, restrictive thoughts around him, that he has to deal with every day.
Well, and in talking about the Christ, I mean, even the idea that he was purified, he was pure in the first place. So, to that degree, I think the persecution follows the best. Because even though where was there any tiny thing that he'd ever done, and yet he was persecuted for it. That to me is the greatest example. And it will come to some degree on his followers in various ways, and I'm sure some of you have come upon it. And that's the cup, because he had to, Mrs. Eddy says, he had to rebuke sinners pointedly and unflinchingly. And that often results in persecution. And you have to. And it's not people that you're rebuking. It's an error. You've got to do it, or it'll get you. Just the way of it. And as you do that, you will be persecuted. And if you grow from it, you will shed a lot of mortal mind thinking and be much freer than you've ever known possible. The next section, Connie wrote about on the forum. So, Connie, would you read what you wrote about on 1 Corinthians?
Ooh, read it. Wait a minute.
Well, read it, tell about it, whatever. However.
Summarize it.
Oh, okay. Well, I was quite astonished whenever I found this, and it's a commentary, can't think of the name of it right now, but it's a guy that's very familiar with all the Jewish writings. And the Jewish concept of passing through the sea, the people were under the cloud at that time, and they passed through the sea. The waters were high on either side of it, and it's a type of baptism that they had before they entered onto the journey, before they could enter into the promised land. And the cloud, I always had this idea of the cloud from a Cecil B. DeMille movie I saw, where the people were trudging along and there was this big old cloud, almost like a tornado out of the sky, that would lead them, and that's how they knew where to go. But the cloud was all around them. It was over them, around them, and under them. It went before them to clear the way, and well, of course, it's the Christ, and that's where we are. I've really enjoyed working with this, thinking in spirit. They were moving in spirit, and there's not a single destructive element in spirit, and thus their shoes did not wax old. And the manna came down from heaven, as did Christ, the bread of truth, or the bread of life. It was round, symbolizing infinity, white, symbolizing purity. And the tradition says that whatever people were hungry for, whatever taste they wanted, that's what it would taste like to them. And so you would think it would be satisfying, but no, they actually wanted real flesh to eat. And so we're not satisfied by that. And the spiritual rock, whenever the water came out of the rock when Moses struck it with the rod, it followed them. It gave them water to drink for 38 years until they came to Kadesh, where they had their next trial going into the promised land. And so that small bit of verses there is just so full of meaning. Amazing.
It is. Thank you. And then you concluded with what? Because if you go on reading in that chapter, what does it bring out about them?
Their dissatisfaction.
Yes.
And don't ever be dissatisfied, because we live in spirit. We're totally protected. We're totally supplied. We just have to recognize it.
Yes. The more you recognize it, the more you will see it, the more it'll be in your life, the more it will manifest. Your thinking determines so much. That's what we are. And when you're always seeing the hole in the donut, you will have that hole. Not because it's there, really, but because that's what your blinded eyes are focused on.
Another thought I had about that was, seeing everything in spirit, which has not a single destructive element, and any spiritual idea, America, has not a single destructive element. The body has not a single destructive element. Every spiritual idea has not a single destructive element.
That is beautiful. Thank you, Connie. Good treatment. And it's the truth. And that's how these are the things, you know, that you get and that you can work with for yourself on a watch. Because this is the truth of our being, truth with a capital T, as given to us through the Bible and by Mary Baker Eddy. So the forum was rich, and I think I'm going to have Linda end it with her comments from 2 Corinthians.
Okay.
And thank you very much, Connie. Go ahead. Linda.
All right, pulling it up. All right. So it was from the quote that said, "Known Christ after the flesh." Paul, before his conversion, had looked for a temporal reigning, not a spiritual Messiah. The whole ceremonial law is at end. This is really no different than using God to make our lives comfortable rather than to be made new. We cannot drink of Christ's cup in this attitude because it lacks true love, honesty, and willingness to work. And then he continued that quote. It says, "Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away." Old things are passed away. The old course of living, the old way of serving God, whether among Jews or Gentiles, the old legal righteousness, old companions and acquaintances are dropped. And all external things, as riches, honors, learning, knowledge, former sentiments of religion, are relinquished. Behold, all things are become new. And then this is a quote from, do you want me to read Gill's exposition?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, this is from Gill's exposition. All the shadows of it are fled and gone. There is no more serving God in the oldness of the letter, but in the newness of spirit. All the former idols he worshipped, he turns from, and his language is, what have I to do any more with idols? Or what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? All former sacrifices, superstitious rites, and ceremonies, which with he worshipped them, are relinquished by him, with all the heathenism, customs, rules, and methods of conduct he had been used to. Behold, all things are become new.
Thank you. It's a good thought to end on, the sanctification process, what that requires. Certainly giving up seeking Jesus or seeking anything in the flesh, personality, personal sense, seeing it that way, rather than seeing the Christ idea. Seeking it for, as James and John did, what are you going to get from it? Instead of a pure motive, and to be willing to get rid of the old man and to be renewed with the new. So, thank you all.
So let's go bring in the millennium.
Yeah, let's go and bringing in the millennium. As we do all this, we will bring in the millennium. So let's get to it. So, thank you all. We'll
thank
have
you
a good
all.
Good service. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.